Are the goals of justice and conflict resolution sometimes mutually exclusive? A case in point, Darfur. At least 300,000 dead, nearly 3 million more forced from their homes amid widespread atrocities the United States describes as genocide. Where is the justice? Well, earlier this month, the International Criminal Court charged Sudan's President Omar al-Bashir with war crimes. But that could make the crisis much worse. Non-governmental organizations that provide food and shelter in Darfur have been kicked out. So is the goal here justice or conflict resolution, which could mean negotiations with the president and his supporters and concessions to them? Where is the priority? Few know more about this dilemma than Louise Arbour, who served as chief prosecutor for the International Criminal Tribunals for Rwanda and the former Yugoslavia. She went on to become the head of the United Nations Commission for Human Rights and now takes up a new position as president and CEO of the International Crisis Group, a non-governmental organization involved in conflict prevention and resolution. Louise Arbour joins us from the studios of the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation in Toronto, and it's lovely to have you today on Talk of the Nation. Welcome.
Thank you.
And the situation in Darfur, where is the priority? Should the priority be on trying to do the best you can for the people in Darfur and negotiating with the government, or should be seeking justice by indicting the president?
Well, I think trying to do the best for the people of Darfur includes, in my view, making accountable those who have been preying on the people of Darfur since 2003 with total impunity. I don't think the two are incompatible. And it's not as though, frankly, we were on the eve of a major peace breakthrough in a region where the government has been, you know, pushing just small tactics of appeasement to keep the international community away as it pursues its what some have called a genocidal campaign, although the International Criminal Court has not gone quite that far.
Yet, as you know well, there are many experts who say, no, we were not on the brink of a breakthrough, but we may be on the brink of a greater disaster if those non-governmental organizations are thrown out. Already, the World Food Program is getting ready for the arrival of tens of thousands more refugees in eastern Chad.
But you see, doesn't that tell you a lot in and of itself that in... You know, the only form of retaliation against the international community and against the International Criminal Court that the president of Sudan can think of is to further attack his own vulnerable population by withdrawing from them the minimal amount of support and relief that they were getting from international and some national NGOs. It seems to me that that is telling you a lot about what needs to be done to stop these kinds of atrocities. You know, the danger is to then become hostage to that maneuver and to try to appease it by making all kinds of promises. At the end of the day, this indictment cannot go away. It will not go away. It could be suspended temporarily by the Security Council, but the reality is this indictment will stay there until the arrest warrants are executed.
Yet, so far, there's no indication that anybody's going to execute those arrest warrants. The president was recently out of the country and nothing happened, and he is perfectly fine in his own country.
Well, you see, President Milosevic had exactly the same attitude of early defiance vis-a-vis his own indictment. And eventually, he was transferred to The Hague, not through a third-party intervention or a spectacular sort of international kidnapping by paratroopers. Essentially, it's his own people, politically, internally, domestically, who realized that their future was not with him. Basically, you know, turned the entire political climate inside the country. In the case of Milosevic, who was indicted as a sitting head of state, and within, you know, whatever it was, 18 months or so, was then transferred to The Hague very peacefully.
And were there predictions at that time that the indictment of the sitting head of state of Serbia would be counterproductive?
They were. Actually, you know, we have so few precedents that it's very difficult to make intelligent, informed predictions about the consequences of this justice initiative. The United Nations has only been in the justice business for less than 15 years, and there are very few precedents as to, you know, what to expect and how these arrest warrants will be executed. But the reality, I mean, we forget the many successes, the peaceful unfolding of this process. I mean, we've had both Milosevic and subsequently Radovan Karadzic in the case of the former Yugoslavia, quite apart from dozens more less well-known figures. We've had Charles Taylor of Liberia, who's currently in custody in The Hague, also standing trial before the Sierra Leone Special Court. And then in the case of Rwanda, you know, most of the leadership of the genocide has been apprehended and you know, taken in custody in Arusha to face trial. So the few precedents we have, it's not that much so far, but indicate that, in fact, it may take time, but this process will unfold exactly as it was designed to be.
If you'd like to join the conversation, we're asking the questions, can the goal of justice and conflict resolution sometimes be mutually exclusive? Our phone number, 800-989-8255, or email us, talk@npr.org. And this can become very frustrating. You've mentioned some examples in recent years which have done rather better. There are other slightly less recent examples in Cambodia, for example, where it is just now, after all those years, after the killing fields in Cambodia, that a few of those alleged to be responsible are being brought to justice.
Yeah, that's true. And in fact, I mean, the reality is that between the Nuremberg trials in 1993, when the Security Council created this first initiative, this ad hoc tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, we did nothing. And most predators of that nature ended up in a villa somewhere, either in the south of France or in, you know, whatever property they could buy, and lived happily ever after. That scenario certainly is finished. Their political future is considerably narrower. The world has become, I think, a much smaller place for them. I mean, President Bashir traveled to Eritrea. He traveled to Egypt. I think he's choosing his destinations extremely carefully, rightly so.
I don't think he's coming to Washington anytime soon. You're right about that. But nevertheless, there are any number of former dictators who say, look, we can do this hard or we can do this easy. I will leave the country if you will allow me to take some large percentage of the riches I may have stolen from my people and to retire to the south of France.
Well, I think some of these arrangements, if I could put it this way, may be possible, but it has to happen much earlier in the process than after somebody has been indicted by a legitimately set up international court, for instance. But even if they do that, we now have a system that's called universal jurisdiction in national courts. You saw what Spain did to General Pinochet. Mm-hmm. There are more and more countries who have equipped themselves, as they're entitled to do in international law, with the competence to judge people for war crimes, certainly crimes against humanity and violations of the torture convention, wherever these crimes have been committed. So, you know, if these guys are getting legal advice, they should be very prudent about relying on undertakings that they will be left alone.
Our guest, Louise Arbour, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights from 2004 to 2008, the former Chief Prosecutor for the International Criminal Tribunals for the former Yugoslavia and for Rwanda, now the incoming President and CEO of the International Crisis Group. Let's even get a caller on the line. This is Bob. Bob with us from Columbus, Ohio.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Difficult enough to negotiate when you have the problems that you just described, but how do you adjust and accommodate when one or the other or both sides claim God is on their side?
Did you have a specific case in mind, Bob?
No, just generally. It's always, it just gets more difficult because, like John Danforth said, things come out in religion is based on principle and negotiations just on laws and other things.
Louise Arbour, can you help us out with that?
There's no question that it makes it a lot more difficult when criminal activities, what are in law, clearly criminal activities, are rooted in a sense of superior calling or people who think they're not answerable to men's justice, but that they're only answerable to their religious leaders or to God. It certainly complicates things. But I think we see the same thing in the enforcement of national criminal law. You know, the question of motive is not really pertinent to the commission of the crime. And I think we have to stand very firm in approaching accountability as a secular issue.
And indeed, in the case of Mr. Milosevic, it was not a religious, but a nationalistic excuse that he gave.
Well, yes, but frankly, nationalism taken to that level has the flavor of, you know, it's beyond ideology. It actually is said to be inspirational. It's true that it was not rooted in any organized religion as such, but it had this fervor that made it, frankly, quite as irrational as extreme religious pursuits.
Bob, thanks very much for the phone call. Sure. And Louise Arbour, I wanted to ask you, how do you see the difference between your job as you move from being the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights and then become the head of a non-governmental organization with many roles, but among them advocacy?
Well, for one thing, I'm not there yet, but I can assume there'll be considerably more institutional freedom, I think, to work within a civil society organization than there is within the United Nations, which, as you know, for its high-ranking officials, has a lot of institutional constraints. So I'm really looking forward to the broad freedom that comes from working inside civil society. It's also, of course, there's also the bureaucracy. International Crisis Group is a very agile organization. It's on the ground. That's why the quality of its research and analysis is so high. It's out there at a senior enough level that representatives in the field have terrific access to government leaders and so on. So I'm really looking forward to working with an organization that is much leaner than anything I ever saw in the UN, and as I said, agile and very relevant.
She's talking about the International Crisis Group, where she takes over as president and CEO shortly. Louise Arbour, of course, is her name. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. But also, as you say, some of the people in this group have access to senior government officials in various places. Do you prioritize to places where you can have influence, where people will listen to you, where you can affect opinion in a country and opinion in a country will make a difference? Or do you prioritize, for example, a place like North Korea, which is very difficult to influence?
Well, again, I think within the resources that we have to be very strategic. And not waste these limited resources in pursuing something that is very unlikely to yield any results. But International Crisis Group has a history, in my view, it's a unique organization in that way, of being right in there, at the cutting edge of the most highly publicized conflict where lots of others are also paying attention, but at the same time at speaking out in its prevention mode in trying to attract world's attention to the conflicts that have the possibility of flaring up and that are attracting absolutely no attention or interest. And that, I think, is a strategic decision that's very worthwhile. The key is prevention. It's bad enough to do conflict management and conflict resolution. But if we could get there early enough and diffuse potential political crisis by mobilizing both inside the country and in sort of the neighborhood or in the powerful environment to try to intervene in good time, I think that's an extremely useful initiative.
Let's talk with Karana. Karana with us from South Bend, Indiana.
Yes, hi. I think that the justice systems, in targeting just the leaders in a country, like in the case of Charles Taylor or Thomas Lubanga, he wasn't a leader, but he was a rebel leader, I think they don't necessarily take into the larger impact you're going to have on the country, and they don't seem to have a preventive impact. I mean, in Congo, we saw new rebels popping up even after, long after the indictment and the arrest of Thomas Lubanga. And the case of Charles Taylor in Liberia is still having, still has a very rocky political scenario. I don't think that his arrest put to rest the threats against that country.
Well, you know, I mentioned before, we've only been in this business for about 13, 15 years. And so invariably in that first decade, the justice initiative was very reactive. You know, we didn't have a kind of international criminal law enforcement system in place ready to be activated in a preventive mode and even barely in real time. It was very much after the fact, certainly in the case of Yugoslavia, in the case of Rwanda. I think what we start to hear now more and more, if you think of Sri Lanka, for instance, where catastrophic attacks on civilian populations are unfolding on a daily basis as we speak, you heard last week my successor, the High Commissioner for Human Rights, warn both the LTTE and the government forces that they may come a point where they will have to be made to account for what, on the basis of the limited information that transpires so far, seems to be the perpetration of war crimes and crimes against humanity, attacks on civilians that are totally unjustified. And as we get better, I think we'll be able to to activate this kind of deterrent system much more.
The LGT, the Tamil Tigers, accused of, and Karana, thanks to the call, accused of using civilians as shields, nevertheless, and the government says it's doing all it can to prevent civilian casualties, nevertheless, in a diminishing rebel area, attacks continuing daily, as you suggested. And what do you do about a case like Sri Lanka, where indeed this has been going on so long and so long that people are almost exhausted with it? Few people pay attention.
Well, that's exactly right. And I think that's exactly what the government is capitalizing on, that it will actually manage to, in its view, complete this military campaign successfully, which many people doubt can be achieved, particularly considering the methods that are used and how they're further alienating even moderate Tamils outside the country and inside the country. But I think to start issuing these warnings, you know, to say, even though you're trying to hide, there is enough information. We know that 40 to 50 people a day, civilians, innocents, are being killed in zones where about 150,000 are trapped and have nowhere to go because you're not allowing an evacuation plan. You know, they understand that they are venues now, either in individual countries or before international courts, where one day they may just have to answer for that. It's hard to measure whether that has any resonance, but I believe that when they look at where Charles Taylor is sitting today and where President Bashir most likely will sit one day, it's food for thought.
Louise Arbour, we wish you the best of luck in your new job.
Thank you.
Louise Arbour is the former UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, soon to be the next president and CEO of the International Crisis Group, with us today from the studios of the CBC in Toronto. Tomorrow at Science Friday, Ira Flatow will be here with a look at a new study that thinks a thinning brain cortex to depression. That's tomorrow, and of course, much more on Science Friday. We'll talk to you again on Monday. Have a great weekend. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.